right, everyone. Thank you so much for attending this webinar with me today. Or first, I'm Fredrik Dybwad. I'm the equity analyst covering shipping at Fearnley Securities. With me today, I have Kristian Sørensen, CEO of BW LPG. I have Mats Zacho, CEO of Navigator Gas, and Ted Young, CFO of Dorian LPG. So before we kick off, I will just talk a bit about the last time we sat down. Was the panel in Marine Money, New York, in June, at least for you, Kristian and Mats. Back then, freight rates on the spot side hovered around the $50,000 a day mark and has since then declined slightly to today's level of around mid $30,000 a day. So this is still a good portion above the cash break-even levels, but have been slightly underwhelming for investors, which have been a bit spoiled by outsized profits for the past couple of years. Normalization of Panama have opened up for transits to head back to normal. Interestingly, bulkers and LNG vessels in particular are now transiting less than before the draft, which may have partly attributed to low freight rates and also call it low freight rates in the LNG and bulker segments, and also some draft issues for bulker vessels in the Mississippi River following a period of bad weather. So that has opened up for more VLGCs to go through the canal, and we have observed the trailing 6 month average transits in both the new and old blocks being higher compared to the pre-restriction averages. And also the order book is fairly big considering the VLECs and VLECs included, though the fleet growth looks to be manageable for the next couple of quarters. And for the smaller sizes, however, the order book is a bit lower. So let us kick off with the call it big small combo, namely the big picture for the smaller vessel classes. So Mats, with freight rates for the handy size tonnage now being still at historical highs despite the historical leading factor in VLGCs correcting, could you just shed some light on what have been the main drivers of this?
Yeah, I guess there's quite a difference between the movements in the VLGC rates and the ones that we're experiencing in the Handysize segment. They have decoupled, or they've never really been very highly correlated. So it's a different supply-demand picture, particularly on supply of new vessels. If we look at the small gas vessels, there's only about 5% of the fleet on water that is in the order book now to be delivered over the next 3 years. So it's probably we are going to see a negative fleet growth in that segment. Moving to the Handysize segment, there's 10 vessels on order out of 127. It's a relatively narrow niche, and with only 8% of the fleet in order books, it's also very manageable. And keep in mind here also that more than 20% on the fleet on water is more than 20 years of age. So we'll see scrapping in that segment too. So again, here over the next couple of years in the handy segment, there's a likelihood that we'll see negative fleet growth. Then with mid-sizes, it's a little bit different. There are more ships on order, but our main interest is the ethylene-capable vessels. And here, the order book is also not very large. I mean, we mainly consist of the order book of 7 ships where we have 4 on order. So again, not much to worry about on the supply side here. So that together, I guess, gives a background for why we're optimistic on the market. And we've also seen that demand has been brisk over the summer and the fall. So we have seen rates being pretty stable at the high level. So.
Yeah, do you see any type of ordering activity now for the smaller vessels, or
No,
is
no.
so?
Yeah, we think that it's going to be a picture that will remain. The yards are very busy in China. In particular, they are happy taking in long series of bigger ships. And if you show up and say, "Hey, can you make 2 smaller ships for me?" They're really not that interested. So it's not easy to break into the market and have new smaller gas carriers built at this point in time.
Yeah, so I guess the rates need to move a bit more up for that to become attractive.
Yeah, and mind you that this segment has not been terribly profitable for the last 4, 5 years, so there's still a need to build some some build up some capital before there's an interest in ordering ships in those segments.
Yeah, and thank you for that. And you know, switching gears a bit, going over to this, the larger vessel classes, you know, for a sustained period of time, the VLGC spot freight rates averaged close to $100,000 a day. That led to significant profits, naturally, and also a steep deleveraging, high dividends, and solid dividend yields. So, was this a super cycle seen only every decade or so, or what actually drove this, Christian?
Well, if it's going to return anytime soon, that remains to be seen, of course. So it's hard to say if it's once a decade or more frequent. But obviously, the what's a game changer between 2023 and 2024 is the primarily the Panama Canal, which you touched upon in the introduction as well, because last year, you know, more ships had to sail the longer route via South Africa on its way to and from the US and Asia. Today, that's not really happening to the same extent, not even near to the same extent. So most VLGCs are comfortably, you know, booking transit slots through Panama, and then it's a more efficient fleet that we are seeing globally today than last year. But I would say that the market has three engines. You know, it's export growth from the US and exports from the Middle East, and then the Panama Canal. And at the moment, I would say the market is firing on just one cylinder, which is the increase in exports from the US. So, of course, if we see more congestion in the Panama Canal, that would be instantly reflected in the rates. And but still today we are, especially out of the US Gulf, seeing rates in the range of $40,000 a day, which is still quite healthy compared to the cash break-even level.
Yeah, and what do you think is, you know, needs to be a catalyst for rates to rebound? We can just if we just break it down a bit first, how on the Middle East export side, what do you think needs to happen there for exports to come up?
Well, I think the Middle East has been sliding sideways, or is stable exports basically, and maybe even a slight decline from last year. But it's what we're waiting for there is the new volumes to come on stream from Qatar, and then later Abu Dhabi on the back of these new LNG trains. So while in the US, you know, that's there is more growth to be expected at least towards the end of next year with more terminal capacity coming on stream. So it's we have to wait a bit longer for the Middle East exports to increase from today's levels.
Yeah. So and also for the past weeks, and Ted and Mats, feel free to chime in on this, but rates have been fairly or remarkably stable for the past couple of weeks and months. What do you think is the reason behind the low volatility of rates?
Well, from my perspective, it's just an absence, you could say, of big news. What we'll see going forward is that when we open our terminal in Morgan's Point, we'll see more ethylene being exported, and we'll see more flows of volumes, and we think that may have a positive impact on rates overall. So it's the fundamentals look good, whereas you could say over the past 1 or 2 months in our market there hasn't been so much change overall. If you look at, you could say, the political agenda, we may come back to that in a little bit, but with the new presidency of the US, we see an over or underlying positive development in for our markets and the general production of natural gas liquids coming out of that. So looking forward, I guess we have more support for the market coming.
Yeah, and another important factor, of course, is the Panama Canal. That is, you know, as important as ever. How do you assess the outlook for the coming months, Ted? Especially considering that transits on the VLGC side have come up as of late.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that we see too much changing. I think, as Christian mentioned earlier, I think we're all kind of a bit surprised that we haven't seen more container ship volume. But I think, I think given the concerns around the possible port strike in the US, some of those trains were pulled forward because of the Christmas shopping season. As we were discussing as well, we were kind of all hoping that we'd see more LNG demand. That doesn't seem to be materializing so much in the near term, given what we see going on in that segment. So, I mean, I guess as I look at, where we are, I was just looking at the stats recently. I mean, we've been kind of bumping around this, 450, 460 transits per month, for the last several months. And, I don't see any catalyst to change that. And, the other thing that continues to be an overhang in the on the market from our perspective is are these terminaling fees. Now, they've come off some. I think we peaked at sort of $150 a metric ton based on the data we're looking at. And the data is by no means perfect out there because the participants have a great desire to keep that quiet. Moderated is something more like, below 140 during October. And the ARBs come in some. We were at, up to $300 a metric ton. As we sit here today, it's, I don't know, $180 a metric ton for the near months, and it sort of goes down as you look out forward. So, it all sort of suggests more of the same. I don't think we're predicting any rate cataclysms, but I don't think that there's anything in the near term that could change. I will say, though, just picking up on Mads's point about the geopolitical environment and also picking up on Christian's point about Middle Eastern demand, the one hickey I would say that we see in Middle Eastern exports is that the biggest exporter is Iran, and neither Christian nor I can lift those cargoes. There are about 51 VLGCs dedicated to that trade. That's the majority of the fleet over 20 years of age. I think of the 5% year-over-year growth, I think probably more than 100% of that is due to Iran. So if Mr. Trump returns to maximum pressure and LPG gets caught up in that, which could have ramifications for trade with China, that could actually be really quite positive for our sector because, that would just, mean that the rest of the world would have to step in and make up those Iranian tons.
Yeah, and on that topic, of canals and Trump, there is another canal that has been experiencing disruptions lately, the Suez Canal. Trump is approaching his second term. He has swore to make peace in the world, or at least give it an honest attempt. If Suez were to transit as normal again, how would this impact your business? You could perhaps just to continue on your end, Ted, and then move on to potential
Yeah,
implications for.
it really wouldn't have a huge impact on our business. If you look at the two main trade basins being the U.S. Gulf and the Arabian Gulf, vast majority of trade goes to Asia. So and currently, these days, Northwest Europe tends to get supplied out of the U.S. So from a VLGC perspective, we didn't really see too much of an impact in our business. And we don't see a huge impact in the unwinding. There was an impact. I should clarify that a little bit. So when the Panama Canal was just impossible to get through, there was certainly good reason, and we did, and I know others did, go through the Suez because it was just faster than either going the long way around Cape of Good Hope or trying to roll the dice at the Panama Canal. But sort of, the Houthis getting active and conditions normalizing, the Panama Canal sort of went in sync. So I think, the impact was relatively muted from our perspective as we looked at it. So not I don't at this point foresee any big change, but who knows?
Yeah, on our side, I can say that the Red Sea doesn't have any impact on our business at all. We have very, very few transits in a normal year through the Red Sea. Either we do transatlantic, transpacific, or we do regional distribution. So very little impact here. And when it comes to the Panama Canal, that also turned out to have relatively little impact on our business. Last year, it simply meant that some of our cargoes were, you could say, switched from being mainly ethylene to ethane that kept flowing south of Africa. So it was really just a substitution, and it ended up having a relatively minor impact on our business. So not much impact on our business from neither the Red Sea or the Panama Canal.
Yeah, thank you. And that's also what I have been seeing myself, and call it a bit less geopolitical risk compared to other segments in that respect. But if we can just switch gears a bit, talk a bit about the arbitrage. The East-West arbitrage is a very important aspect of the LPG trading market, also the main driver of freight historically. Owning ships is one way to capitalize on the market, on the arbitrage. Owning terminals or trading business is another. So Kristian, BW Product Services have been showcasing stellar performance since you took them in, and how do you intend to grow that part of your business in the future?
Yeah, well, we are quite happy with the size the Product Services outfit has at the moment. So we are primarily a shipping company, but of course, compared to where products, the team that is now Product Services came from, we have grown the business. But it's not that we have ambitions to grow it massively more than we already have. But what's been important for us is to establish this business model where we can participate in value creation also in other parts of the value chain, especially when shipping is a bit more challenging. And that's, I think, what we saw happened in Q3 when profit in the LPG value chain moved more, let's say, moved from shipping more towards the cargo and the terminal owners. And that's what is reflected in today's results presented for Product Services as well. But having said that, it's important to note that the majority of the positive result is an accounting result, right? So it's the improved valuation of their forward trading portfolio, which is the major share of that accounting profit that we reported on today. But of course, that hopefully will be realized in the quarters to come. And I think for us, it's been important to see and kind of prove that this business model is giving us another leg to stand on when the freight markets are a bit more challenging.
Yeah, and since the end of 3Q, the arbitrage have narrowed somewhat. So could you just also give a bit color on the dynamic of the arbitrage, how that usually plays out for the profits in the Product Services?
Well, there is not necessarily, of course, they trade on price differentials between the regions. So a wide arbitrage is, I would say, in general, more favorable than if it's a narrow arbitrage. That goes without saying. But they also have many other handles to pull in terms of how to position themselves.
Yeah, I think we lost Christian there for a second.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's see, he doesn't come back in the next couple of seconds there. We can just
Can you hear
move
me? There
on.
he
Yeah,
is. I think he's
there we
back.
go.
I don't know where he lost me, but I'm just saying that the Product Services. Can you hear me now? Yeah. So Product Services, they have many handles to pull in order to position themselves in the trading market. So it's FOB, CFR cargoes, derivatives. They can position themselves on the shipping side. So I would say that overall, it's hard to. There is not like a one-to-one link between the arbitrage and how they what kind of profit they make. But on a general basis, of course, the more room there is between the U.S. FOB pricing and the CFR pricing in Asia or in Europe, the better it is. But it's not like a one-to-one link. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Thank you for that color. And besides BW Navigator, you have an export terminal,
Oh
a
yes.
little bit of a different product, but we can touch back that on a bit later on. But because at Dorian you are still a pure play shipping company, Ted, is that also the plan going forward?
At this point, yes. We have spent time considering trading in the past. We've definitely looked at terminal investments a number of different times. I'd say never say never. I mean, I think as Mads has sort of alluded to, and you can look at the public numbers of their partner and all the U.S. midstream companies. In my opinion, the midstream guys in the U.S. have some of the most powerful economics and best business models of anything in the energy business out there. It really is kind of a heads we win, tails you lose kind of thing. And so from my perspective, if there were a way to participate on a basis that made sense from a risk-adjusted return perspective, that'd be nice to participate in those kind of economics. On the other hand, I think like Christian said, I think we still see ourselves at our core as a shipping company, and anything we do, would be to sort of improve the overall economics alongside of it. And it's an interesting conundrum because a lot of people invest in shipping because of its volatility, and anything that reduces that volatility, at least for some people, would make the share less attractive because of what it's designed to do. So I think sort of balancing those competing masters is going to go into our thinking as we continue to evaluate different ways to look at our business.
Yeah, and you, as we all know, you have a pretty substantial war chest at your disposal. So, are there any attractive deals out there right now? Is it on the secondhand side, resale side, or is it on the new building side?
I'd say less on the new building side, but
Yeah.
there's always interesting things to look at. Look, I think from the new building perspective, we obviously have one new building. I think the bigger issue for us right now is, yeah, prices are firm, but they're not impossible by any stretch to justify when you look at sort of the 10 and 15 year VLGC average rates. But on the other hand, getting delivery late 27, maybe 28. Well, that's a long way away in our world. There's so much happening with energy transition and all sorts of energy saving devices. Who the heck knows what it's going to be? And so I think you never say never, but otherwise, I think there's probably some interesting opportunities that are more that would put more immediate cash flows in our shareholders' pockets than new builds.
And I agree with you there. And on the topic of fleet growth, I think you knew that this was coming, Christian. But last time we spoke at Marine Money, I bit jokingly asked you about whether when you were going to acquire the Avance Gas fleet. Now we have done it. So how does this position you for 2025?
Obviously, we're super happy with the transaction, and it's been the deliveries have been going very smooth so far. We have five out of the 12 ships delivered as of today, and expect the remaining part of the fleet to be delivered within time by the end of this month. Like I said many times before, we would not have done that transaction could we not use our share as a currency in the transaction. And I think we believe in the market. We just like Ted said, we think it's been hard to justify the elevated asset prices over the last years. But the way we managed to structure this deal made it look different for us, right? Because we could use the share as a currency. So we are very happy to add on more earnings power and look forward to an interesting 2025 where we have a positive outlook. And like I said, there is more volumes to come further out on the curve. So we feel that we are positioning ourselves pretty well for this.
And a little bit of a follow-up on that. Would you still have the flexibility to do more deals after this is, digested and absorbed?
In theory, yes, but I, like I said, we do feel that the asset prices are too elevated at the moment, so it's not something that you should anticipate, if I can use that word.
Yeah. Yeah, and Mats, you guys at the Navigator Gas have also been active on the fleet side. You have some new
Yeah.
buildings under construction, and
Yes.
could you give us some insight on this investment?
Yeah, I mean, in Navigator, we have a fleet of 56 vessels, and we haven't ordered a ship for almost 10 years. So you cannot continue operating a fleet forever without, at some point in time, doing proper fleet renewal, and that's what we're doing. So I think in that context, four vessels on order is not a huge thing. It's important for us, and we're also building ships that we think will support the terminal expansion that we are just finalizing now. So it's important that not only do we deliver the capacity for ethylene export, we also ensure that there are ships to actually move it. So I think we are making sure that the ends meet on this one. We're building the ships so that they can be retrofitted. They're dual fuel, ethane, marine fuel oil, and they can be retrofitted to ammonia. They can also be retrofitted with CO2 capture equipment and shore power as well. So we're building a ship that has enormous flexibility to whatever happens down the line in terms of carbon levy or technical restrictions on emissions, et cetera, et cetera. So, and then it's a ship that is entirely optimized to meet our customers' requirement right now. They can go through the old locks in the Panama Canal, and so they're giving maximum economics of scale for those that want to transport ethane or ethylene across the Pacific or across the Atlantic. So I think it's future-proofing our company, but without going overboard in any direction.
Yeah, and also, speaking of investing, you have this huge expansion now going on, or in the last final phases at Morgan's Point and the ethylene export terminal. How is 2025 looking on that front in terms of offtake of that the additional capacity?
Yeah, as we've also commented on previously, that there is one customer that has signed up, and there are multiple negotiations ongoing right now, and when they have been signed, we will of course make announcements around that. But it's still ongoing, signing up that offtake for the first terminal that started out for about 4 years ago, 1 million tons per annum. We had 94% offtake multi-year signed up around the time when it became active, the terminal. So we expect to see something broadly similar. There may be a little bit more spot capacity on the terminal. We don't mind having that, but there will be significant offtake put in place for this one as well. So we are adding 550,000 tons of capacity, and with a flex feature that can expand that all the way up to 3 million tons over time. So quite exciting. We spent a lot of cash flow investing into it, $130 million over the past year and this year. And from next year onwards, there'll be no CapEx, but there'll be dividends and cash flow coming in from it. So we really appreciate that, and we think strong, predictable cash flows, that's what our investors like.
Yeah, well, I totally agree. And you touched upon it. You could increase it further up until 3 million tons per annum. Does that how much of an investment does that require from your end?
That doesn't require any further investment at all, but it of course requires that our partner over time will make the flex feature available for more ethylene and do more ethane when they do their expansions up in Beaumont, which is currently ongoing. So it's going to be something that will happen over time. We'll not go to 3 million tons of ethylene in 25. We'll probably start out at 550 plus some, but then gradually over the years we expect it to build up. But no further CapEx is required for that.
That's very, very positive developments happening at the moment in your company. And
Yeah.
Switching gears a bit again, talking about circling a bit back to the order book, is not insignificant at just above 40% for the VLGCs if you include the ammonia carriers and ethane carriers. Ted, what's your take on the current order book size? And do you have seen any change in who is doing the ordering, or Does it is it the same the usual suspects ordering vessels still?
Yeah, it's mostly the usual suspects. You know, a few, you know, you're seeing some more interest from, you know, I don't know, like, you know, people partnering with JERA in Japan to, you know, who wants to deliver ammonia. So that's new business, though. Otherwise, you know, it's a lot of the same folks. You know, I do kind of eliminate the ethane guys a little bit because that's a really bespoke trade. And, you know, we've looked at that trade ourselves. It's certainly got its very attractive aspects. But, you know, if you think 120 million is too much for a VLGC to ship propane and butane, you sure as heck don't want to be shipping ethane on a $150, $160 million vessel. So I do think I kind of put those aside. You know, look, no one's going to sit here, no ship owner's going to sit here and tell you that an order book, that anyone likes an order book. I think, you know, breaking it down a little bit, you know, in the near term, you know, 25 is pretty modest, 26 is relatively modest. 27 is obviously a big year of deliveries. You know, on the other hand, you know, the fleet is continuing to age. You know, that bulge of older vessels that's servicing Iran. And again, like we talked about, if there's any, you know, change to that Iran trade, you know, such that the rest of the world has to step in, I think we'll quickly find ourselves short of ships. Now, that's a lot of ifs. So, you know, we'll have to see how it develops. But, you know, I think there's so many things that can happen. You know, I'm stealing Christian's, you know, sort of pithy wisdom here, but, you know, everybody thought 2023 was going to be a bad year because of all the deliveries, and it turned out to be one of the best. Now, we can't sit here and say that's going to be the case in 2027, which is a long way away, but the point is a lot of things can happen between here and there. So, you know, it's obviously something that's on all of our radar screens. It's something that, you know, it's all of our jobs to make sure our companies can trade well, regardless of the rate environment. So, you know, we want to make sure we're well prepared if indeed that ends up being a rough year. But on the other hand, a lot of stuff can happen between now and 2027. So, you know, we're going to keep our eyes open and keep our balance sheet, you know, where it should be, and our cash costs where they need to be. And we'll be ready come what may in 27. But for 25 and 26, we're not losing too much sleep at this point.
And I agree. And call it one of the call it future long-term lines drivers here is call it ammonia. And it's a segment that a lot of participants have high ex anticipations and expectations of, about regarding future growth. Currently, most of the ammonia is, you know, that is transported by sea, goes mainly through the mid-size and size segment. So that gives me takes me back to you, Mats, and the share of ammonia and your trade mix have been increasing as of late. So, could you also shed some color of the main drivers of this trade?
Yeah, I mean, it's at this current point in time, we will have 9 ships operating with or sailing with ammonia, which is about 20% of our fleet. So, let's say 2 years back, before the war in Ukraine started, we'd have maybe 2 or 3 or 4 at max. So it's been a significant increase, and we see that continue. I mean, even if there is to be a peace in Ukraine, which we all hope, it'll take a long, long time before there'll be any product coming out of through Ukraine when it comes to ammonia. So we see the trade flows being solid, and we expect that there'll be continued strong appetite for Handysize-based ammonia transportation. I'm not here starting to forecast what will happen with the energy transition, and once marine fuel becomes or ammonia becomes a marine fuel, that's going to take a couple of years. That'll of course be an incredibly large market, but even for now, when it's mainly used as fertilizer, we see continued strong demand and the trade flows that have supported us having about 9-10 vessels with ammonia. So it's a not an insignificant part of our overall business.
Yeah, and you know, on the call it bit of a closer subject as well, the ethane and ethylene trade. How is the outlook there?
No, I mean it looks good, and the main reason is that we ourselves are producing the demand for the shipping services by opening up the terminal expansion, which means that a lot more ethylene is gonna flow. It is very, very competitively priced in North America, and with more drilling for gas in Texas, there will be more natural gas liquids. That means there will be more ethane and ethylene that will be pushed for export because the demand in the US is capped. So we'll see strong demand for that, and so outlook is good. And we also see that the crackers in Europe, they are not competitive when they are operating on naphtha, so they will gradually have to switch over and use more ethane as feedstock. So we see a continued flow of product across here as well.
Yeah, and where do you see mostly the flows out of the US are heading?
Well, so far it's mainly to China, and then Europe coming in as a right behind it. It tends to change from time depending on where the arbitrage between the regions are moving. But overall, let's say 60% China and 40% Europe. That's how it looks on average over a long period of time. So, and we continue to believe that will be the case.
And on accounting for current and project with FID on the ammonia side, you have a pretty strong growth of almost 8 million tons per annum of blue and green ammonia by 2028. Most of this, as we have discussed, goes by mid-sizes and handy-sizes currently, but beyond that and beyond 2030, I'm a bit curious of your views of the VLACs and the prospects for VLACs and as a future trade beyond the 2030s, Christian.
Yeah, well, like I said before, I'm quite positive for the ammonia market going into 2030s if things are, panning out as we expect. I think what's been a bit disappointing is the slow response in Europe, in the EU, in terms of putting money behind all the nice words about cutting emissions and so on. So I think what we'll see first is that this trade will develop between the US and Japan, maybe Korea, where there is real talks and serious companies behind what seems to be a new market for ammonia in blending it into the coal-fired power plants in Japan. So I think for me, ammonia is definitely an interesting market. I think it will take a little bit longer time to develop than we anticipated a few years ago. But and like I said, I think the trade between the US and Japan, Korea is where we'll see the cargoes move first. Europe is a bit disappointing in my book.
Yeah, I think that we'd probably share that view, Christian, as well. And I think it'll be interesting to see. I certainly share Mads's view that over the longer term, ammonia as a maritime fuel is going to be a big trade in its own right. I think our perspective is in the near term, both given the toxicity issues as well as the scarcity issues, we think the biggest bang for the buck, that's a really terrible pun, apologies, but I think the best opportunity for decarbonization per ton of ammonia applied is really probably going to be in co-gas, right? In reducing the emissions of coal-fired power plants. So I think that's our anticipation of where we'd see the first big demand leg up, and probably secondly, in the maritime sector, because obviously the sector is getting better and better at figuring out, the engine manufacturers about how to deal with, this miracle fuel by all accounts, but one that's quite toxic, and one that's not easy to handle. And so I'm pretty confident that the smart folks at MAN and other Wärtsilä will figure this out, and we'll have a workable engine. But I think that, but again, I think from a demand perspective, power generation is going to be the first and highest calling for that new ammonia capacity.
Yeah, and so oil bit nearly call it as a class that has been emerging, not that big of an order book yet, but CO2 carriers are also an emerging trade. How do you guys feel about that kind of shuttle trade?
No, I think it's inevitable that we'll see large amounts of CO2 being transported by sea, because pipelines are difficult and expensive to build, and they will take the major volumes, but there'll be a lot of landlocked, or you could say stranded CO2 that cannot be moved by pipeline. So ships will be the solution for that. And again, it requires regulation because it's a waste product. So in order to get paid for it, there needs to be some regulation in place to make it happen. And here, we are spending quite a bit of time on it. There will be large volumes, but it's also here maybe taking a little bit longer than what initially we had thought going back a few years.
I agree. I mean, I think the future is exciting. I mean, I think so far, the main event is the Northern Lights project, which has been, years and years and years in gestation. So it probably doesn't meet the investment hurdles of most public companies, just because of the long-term payback. But I think, maybe being the second mover, the third mover is going to be an opportunity. We're interested in it. We actually have a small investment in a decarbonization technology using amine solutions and everything else, which we think could be a great way to reduce carbon emissions on board ships at source. That's another way to come at it. But I think Mads is right that eventually, over time, it's inevitable. Where is it all going to get stored? I don't know. There's only so much. I mean, there's only so much the Icelandic folks and the Greenlandians are going to allow us to actually inject underneath their homes. But I guess we'll see. That'll be another problem for another day.
Yeah, definitely. And we are soon on time. Just to wrap it up a bit on capital allocation, cash flow, dividends, circling back to a bit where we started, because following several years now with strong earnings, all of you have been paying out significant dividends. But your approach, Mats, have been a bit different, and also BW and Dorian, by opting for a combination of buybacks and cash dividends as part of your fixed or capital return policy. And on top of this, you did a 3.5 million share repurchase before the summer. So a bit about what your considerations you are doing when you think about shareholder returns and how it affects also liquidity and also pricing of the equity.
Yeah, no. I think we will continue to do a mix of both. We pay 25% of our net income in capital distribution every quarter, and that's a mix. That's a 5 cents fixed dividend in cash, and then we have in the past typically done buybacks to get up to that 25% of net income, and then on top of that, done the larger share buybacks over the both of this year and last year. And you should expect that we would continue to look at it the same way. We would want to strengthen the return to our shareholders, and we're not maybe so concerned about it driving out liquidity per se. We think that, to the contrary, if we do share buybacks and have an attractive stock to invest in, that will create a li liquidity in it in itself. So, we still like share buybacks, and we think, given where our shares are trading right now, that it's amongst the best investments that we can make for our shareholders.
Yeah, and for you, Kristian and Ted, you also pay out significant dividends, though, in cash. So now that pricing for both of your names have come down to a significant discount to NAV, how do you view share repurchases going forward?
Yeah, I mean, for us, like you say, we have preferred dividends as our way to return value to our shareholders. But if you look over the last years, we have typically reactivated the share buyback program when the share price is trading at what we believe is a low level, and where we can make the best investments actually by buying our own shares. So when and if that happens, that is something I can't really give a clear answer to. But I think going forward, dividends will still be our preferred way of returning value, but we definitely have an active share buyback program which we can reactivate if we think it's right, both in terms of timing and price.
Yeah, I think from a Dorian perspective, we probably tend to have a similar philosophy. Look, I think we've seen the biggest jumps in our total shareholder return through our dividend payments, not as much through our shareholder share repurchases. I think the real question is, you want to buy back when it's cheap, and that's the $64,000 question. When is it truly cheap? And I think the hurdle for a share buyback is even higher than, say, a normal equity investment, because it is an asymmetric trade. It's one way. You can buy back the shares. You really can't reissue them because you have to do it in the context of a registered offering. So you really want to be sure that you're getting a true bargain. There is a benefit, obviously, because you can ostensibly pay out a higher per share value in dividends if you reduce the share count. But I think the trick is making sure that if you do a buyback, that it is indeed cheap. And if you look across all public companies, not just shipping companies, and the numerous academic studies, unfortunately, it's shown that management teams are no brighter than the average investor in repurchasing stock. So I think the name of the game is to do your best to buy it cheaply. We were happy. We bought back 13% of the company at $12.50 a share. That still feels pretty good right now. But we did some open market repurchases at $15 a share, probably 8, 9 years ago. That didn't feel so good after we saw what happened. So again, I think the bar is higher, whereas it's pretty straightforward what a shareholder gets if you give him or her a dollar or whatever you give them per share.
Yeah, and wrapping up, we have a couple of questions from the attendance online. First, it's for Mats. We touched upon this briefly, but you have acted on your options for the 2+2 new buildings. So will these two vessels be going shuttle from your Morgan's Point terminal when they are delivered? And will they exclusively trade in ethylene, or will they trade, or can they, or do trade LPG as well?
They will most likely be trading ethane or ethylene, so gases that require a lot of cooling capacity down to below 100 degrees Celsius. So this is really what they are built for. They are sophisticated, expensive vessels, so it would be a shame, you could say, to use them for ammonia or LPG, but they can. So it's a good, nice, it's a very versatile vessel that can be used for many purposes. We expect that they'll be trading ethane and ethylene. And if you look at our book today, we have some charter cover, typically about 40% or a little bit more than 40% of the next 12 months are covered. For vessels like these, we'd probably look for slightly more cover or slightly longer cover, but having some sort of a mix between some spot exposure and some charter cover, that's really what we want to do, because we want to open up and build a new market for mid-sizes trading ethylene spots over time, because it gives good scale and economics for our customers. So we will disclose more over time about how the charter cover is going to look, but that's being discussed as we right now.
Thank you. And last one, that is for everyone. What alternative fuel do you see the best sustainable alternative for an LPGC carrier in the future?
LPG. No question.
Right answer.
Yeah, I think for an LPG carrier, ethane for an ethane carrier, or potentially over time, once a levy is imposed and fossil fuels become very expensive, it would have to be something like ammonia, where the CO2 emissions are very low.
We're quite privileged,
I agree,
in that sense, carrying the fuel that we want to burn.
Exactly. And the logistics play into this, because if we are loading those commodities, it's very easy to bunker them at the same time. So even if these fuels are not available in all ports around the world, when we're transporting them, we will have them available, so we can be front runners in that aspect.
Yes, great. So that is now time. Thank you so much for attending the panel, Mats, Ted, and Christian, and also thank you for everyone participating and listening in. And we will see you again soon.
Yeah,
thank
thank you
you
so much.
Nice job.
Bye bye.
Thanks.
Bye. Bye.